So I'm going to start this morning with a story of, from my own life from when I was 21 years old. So if you can just imagine me at 21, I actually am pretty much the same size as I am right now, and I think I still have clothes from that time. Except at the time, I was probably wearing cargo pants and a t-shirt that I silkscreened myself. But I'm young and really less burdened by life. I have no gray hairs. I have less experience and I'm less wise, but just, you know, it's a fun time in your life. So at 21, I was accompanying another young woman on a year's commitment to Japan, where we would be facilitating mission work for a local church there. And we were headed out with all this excitement and with anticipation, having just graduated from university. And like most young people, we really had no idea what we were going to do with our lives, but we just wanted to do something adventurous and really to serve God in a significant and meaningful way. So we were excited about this trip. But my parents, however, had some different ideas about my trip, some different feelings. And so for the preceding weeks, they had been trying to convince me not to go. It was because they were afraid. They didn't want me to be so far away on another continent. They didn't share my faith, so they didn't really trust the organization that sent us. I was the one that set up all of the details, and so they were kind of didn't trust me that I knew enough to arrange something that would be safe for me. And so they were telling me I was too young to do this, and I was too inexperienced, and I was unprepared, and I was really naive. And there was just kind of this onslaught of fear and opposition to my plans. My mom even had people she knew talk to me about all the dangers and scary things that could possibly happen. And she had a friend whose daughter had gone to Japan before. And she had her phone me to tell me how she got lost in the Tokyo subway station. And she cried for hours and hours, and no one helped her. And it was, you know, this horrible thing, and no one spoke English there, and no one would help me when I went to Japan. Just to let you know, this was completely not my experience when I did go. My friend Dana and I that went, we had people who would get off their train, get us on the right train, and come with us to where we needed to go. There was so much kindness that we found. But before we went, we didn't know this. We'd never been. And my parents kind of did their best to scare me. And when I refused to listen to their protests, they told me I was stubborn and I was incorrigible. And that is pretty much true. So, and my now dear friend, Dana, I hadn't met her before, but she flew out from Ottawa the night before we were supposed to fly to the Nagoya airport together. And she was meeting me and my family for the first time. And she has this wonderful family of faith that supported her to go, but she arrived at my house, and I'm pretty sure she could feel the fear in the place. And she woke up in the morning, and she was hoping to encourage me because she'd had a dream that night where the Lord had told her that we would be traveling first class to Japan that day, and that he had everything under his control, and he himself was sending us on this trip. Now, I was familiar with spiritual dreams, the idea of spiritual dreams, but I'd never had one myself. So I was kind of like, okay, we'll see what happens. Like, we booked economy flights, so we're a couple of broke students. Not really sure what's going to happen here, but we got ready to go to the airport. And we board the plane like normal. I found my seat in the economy section near the back of the plane, and Dana's seat was even further behind mine. Only I could hear some confusion as she went to take her seat because they had double booked her seat, and the other passenger had arrived first to claim that chair. So Dana is talking to the flight attendant, and then she's describing how her and I are actually traveling together. And a few minutes later, we are moved to seats in the front of the plane, in first class. So I can't describe, you know, just the fear that I had to wade through to get to that place. But we flew that trip 15 hours in spacious, comfortable seats, drinking free complimentary port. I didn't even know what that was until that moment. And we were watching personalized movies before that was even a thing, because this is 20 years ago, and we didn't have that stuff on planes like we do now. And I've never flown first class before or since, but in that moment, we just knew that God had us, and this was his plan and his trip. And there were, you know, hard things about that year, but that was his sign to us that he was in control. So I share this story to contrast a life of fear and a life of faith, which is, I think, a contrast we also find in the story that Megan read us of the parable of the talents. And this parable is part of a group of parables about judgment, which are not warm and fuzzy in their message. It can be hard to read. In this story, the master is going away, so he entrusts his business to three servants while he is gone. And the first two immediately invest the money and double their investment, while the third digs a hole to hide his master's money. This third servant, in giving his account to the master upon his return, declares that he knew the master was a hard man, and so he was afraid, and he went and hid the money. What I didn't really notice right away when I first read this parable was that this servant doesn't have the same view of the master that the first two servants have. And until this third servant speaks, we have really no indication that the master is hard or unfair or cruel at all. The master clearly feels that he can go away and leave his business and his wealth in the hands of other people, which to me doesn't seem like somebody who's really harsh and controlling and fearful with his possessions. And the scripture said that he entrusted his wealth to them. He has praise and he has joyous exclamation. He's really excited for the first two servants when he says, "Well done, you good and faithful servants." He is cheering on their success. "You've been faithful with a few things, and so I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share in your master's happiness." So he's declaring himself happy, and he rewards them in what appears to be a really free and generous way. He makes clear his confidence in them by adding to their responsibilities, and presumably also this adds to their wealth and their status. What I see in their view and in the story is that this master is marked by trust and generosity, that he is confident and full of joy. And this is totally in direct opposition to the perception of the third servant. The third servant is so afraid of the master that he hides the gold that's given him. And tragically, the master's response to this man is exactly what he fears. He chastises him, he treats him harshly, he takes his gold from him, he ostracizes him, and the words are words of eternal punishment outside in the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I think there appears to be a direct correlation between his fear and his skewed view of his master and his punishment that happens. The judgment parables are sobering. They're uncomfortable. When I look at it, I think, I have no desire for any person to be outside of God's blessing. This is really harsh. And I feel for this third servant who is ruined, his life was ruined by his fear. And yet, I can relate to him in a lot of aspects of my life. There are so many stories from Scripture of people that were fearful. And this servant can claim company with a lot of others who were afraid to trust God. The classic example is Moses, who initially refused God's call to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. And when I read the story about his interchange with God, I think it's almost comical. Like, it's not funny. There's you know, a whole people group in slavery, and this is a disaster and stuff that has, God has heard their cries. But it's funny because Moses is talking with God, and he's God's calling him, and he's talking with God, and God is saying, I want you to go and speak to Pharaoh. I want you to lead the people. And Moses thinks, well, what if they don't listen to me? I'm not really a good speaker. What am I, how can I even do this? And I feel like the Lord is so confident, and he says to him, that's okay, I've got it covered. I'm going to give you this stick, and you're going to throw this stick on the ground, and it's going to become a snake. And then you're going to pick up the snake by the tail, and it's going to become a stick again. And everyone's going to believe by this miraculous sign that I am with you, and they're going to listen to you, and they're going to follow you. And Moses is still like, yeah, but you don't really know that I can't really talk very well, and I don't really think the people are going to believe me. And I feel like the Lord is excited about his plan, and so he's like, it's okay. Take your hand, stick your hand into your coat, and when you pull it out, it's going to be covered in leprosy. And then when you put it back in and take it out again, it's going to be healed. And I've got this awesome sign, and it's a miracle. And when you do it, the people are going to believe that I'm with you, and they're going to listen to you, and they're going to follow you. And Moses and God go back and forth like this, and Moses is protesting. And even after all of these things, he says, pardon your servant, Lord. I'm slow of speech and tongue. Please send someone else. And I think as the conversation progresses, that God is getting exasperated. Like, he's got this awesome plan. He's got all these ideas. And he's directly challenging Moses. And he says, who gave you your mouth? Who makes human beings deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I? Now go. I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you speak, and I'm going to teach you what to say. But Moses still refuses. And the text says that the Lord's anger burns against him. Because I think that Moses is stuck in this idea, like that he's focused on himself not being good enough, which is an insult to God at that moment, because God is asking, do you trust me? And it seems at this point in the story that Moses doesn't really understand yet who God is. So fast forward, Moses has risen to the challenge of leading the Israelites, and they have escaped Egypt, and we're sitting at the edge of the Promised Land, which Adam spoke about a couple weeks ago. And so Joshua is one of the 12 spies sent into the Promised Land to scout out a route for takeover. And we have to keep in mind that this people group is the actual real-life participants in archetypical biblical story of salvation. Like, this is the thing that everybody always goes back to, historically and metaphorically. And they're the first to experience God's awesome power in their release from actual slavery in Egypt. This is pretty awesome things that have happened to them. And God promises them this beautiful, bountiful land to them and their ancestors. And yet the spies come back with a bad report about the land that they had explored. And they say, the people of the land are giants, and we're totally terrified, and we're afraid. And they say, the Lord hates us, so he brought us out of Egypt to destroy us. It's hard when we look at it now to imagine, like, how deep that misunderstanding of God's character and his intentions are. And so Moses and Joshua and Caleb plead with the people, but finally the Lord in his anger doesn't allow any of them to enter the Promised Land except for Joshua and Caleb, who are the only two that weren't afraid. And everyone else dies in the desert. There is an entire generation of people who couldn't take hold of God's awesome gift because of fear and mistrust in God. And I think these stories just ask some really sobering questions about what we're missing out on because of our fear, about what we're not stepping into that was promised us because of fear, And I wonder how fear is messing with our connection to God and our understanding of God and his power. And I think these stories highlight the true condition of our own hearts when we're afraid and we say, I couldn't possibly do that. I'm not as good as someone else would be. Who am I to step out or to lead or to serve or to help that person? Or the problem's too big, or this will never change, or what can I possibly do? What I think we're actually saying along with the third servant is, I don't trust you, God. And we are missing out on the outrageous, fun, rewarding, victorious life that God has for us. We are all afraid, I think, in different ways, that we're not good enough, as if somehow the execution of God's plan actually depended on our abilities. And when I think about how the Israelites entered the Promised Land and the first city they defeat is Jericho, and we know from Sunday school, like, was it through their own strength and practiced battle strategies? Had nothing to do with that. In the parable of the talents, it doesn't really seem to matter how much each servant was given. What mattered was whether each had the faith to invest it. And so I think sometimes I just want to quickly think about comparing ourselves to others, because it's true in the parable that they were given different amounts according to their abilities. And in the ending of the story, the master has this statement that whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. This seems really offensive to my personal sense of fairness. You just have to ask my kids how much they love it when their brother or sister has more than them. It's really great. In my home, there are catastrophic meltdowns over millimeter discrepancies in the amount of juice I put in each of their cups. It's like, who do you like more? Oh my gosh, people. I haven't gotten out a scale, but that's what they would like, I think, to make it all exactly fair. But I think that's all of us. I think it's easy for us not to be satisfied with what God has given us, or to say that my gifts or opportunities really aren't as good or important as somebody else's. It might be really small, that what we've been asked to do, but we look around and to top it off, God seems to actually be giving more to some people intentionally. And it's confusing. How could some people get more and more blessing while other people have what little they have taken away? This is a really maybe deep paradox that is kind of beyond the scope of this message, but I think we have a clue to understanding this dynamic in the actions of these three servants, that investing whatever small offering we have is always better than hiding it in fear. An amazing mystery about the Christian life is that we get to work in partnership with God. The scripture says we're co-laborers with Christ, and that he will give us an appropriate amount of responsibility in accordance with our faith, and it's our opportunity to grow our capacity for more. I, of course, do not have all of this, or maybe even any of it, figured out. I grew up in a really fearful household, and I really have wrestled with fear and anxiety my whole life. And I've lost things because of it. For example, even though I knew from the time I was very young that I wanted to be an artist, like from the time I was 4 years old, I've never fully pursued this path because I'm afraid of failure. In my 20s, when Robin and I were newly married, we were cleaning out my old bedroom at my parents' house, and we were going through all my art portfolios from high school and university. And I just cried because it was good. It was really good, and I knew it, but I was not pursuing art because of fear, and because my own fear and other people who had influenced me, the fear of those other people as well. So even now, As an adult, it's really hard for me to hear God's voice say to me, I made you this way. Use your gift. Enjoy it. And I read the parable of the talents, and I think, imagine that when we use what God gives us, one of his primary intentions is to bring us happiness. So my life is somewhat less epic than leading an entire people group out of slavery. And I think that most of us would relate to that. We don't really do that in our everyday lives. But I recently came up against fear in starting a new project called Heartwood. I'm just going to have a glass of drink of water. So I've been working with homeschooling families for a bunch of years now. And as a teacher in charge of designing educational programs for children in their homes. And it had been a vision of mine, probably since I started years ago, to hold a weekly or bi-weekly class to ease the burden on mothers who I saw really struggling having their kids home 24/7. And I also saw kids who needed friendships and safe spaces to learn and practice essential social skills. And in the spring of 2016, just over a year ago, I was given the opportunity to open a new program, which was pretty much exactly my vision. And it was properly funded, and it was supported by mentors who could mentor, guide me and support me as I opened this up as the primary teacher in this program or school. So I was really excited. And that spring, I hosted a meeting for interested parents. I needed a minimum number of students to start. And the values and format of the program involved creating a community of parents in a somewhat democratic process to decide on the exact nature of what we wanted it to look like. So I also needed some like-minded parents who were open to trying something new, to starting something off the ground, and maybe it wasn't going to be perfect at the beginning. So it really sounds simple. And in retrospect, it seems like, of course, it was going to be successful. But in the evening of the meeting with the parents, it was like, it felt like a fear storm to me. There was just so, I just can't even describe how much fear it felt like was in the room. Parents were worried and suspicious of other parents' agendas for the group. Some parents were worried about whether a publicly funded program would allow them to teach their children from a faith perspective at home, which was a primary importance to them. And others were worried about, they wanted to create all these policies and things, and it just threatened to bog us down before we even got started. And I was afraid. I was afraid that my idea would not be accepted, and that also, deep inside me, it was like, that felt like a personal rejection if people were going to reject this vision. And in short, fear was wreaking havoc on my idea of creating a community that would care and support for each other as we schooled our kids. So it's not that all these ideas didn't warrant consideration or that there weren't some questions that needed to be addressed, some genuine, real questions. It's just that my own worries and fears did nothing to assuage the fears of others. It just amplified everything. And let's be clear that fear is a really poor advisor when it comes to making decisions. If you give fear a legitimate seat at the table, then you're just going nowhere good. So my heart was beating faster, and I was starting to freak out at the intensity of the conversation. And I kind of had this lightning bolt moment where the Lord spoke to me, and he just said, I need you to step up and lead at this table. It's always funny to me that I seem to be the last one to know my own blind spots and also to know my own calling or my own gift. And I think maybe other people have experienced that as well. But I never really considered that I was leading the project. I kind of saw it as more like a democratic, we're all just coming together and building this thing together. And I never considered myself a leader because I have struggled so deeply with fear of failure and not being good enough my whole life. And it doesn't really seem like leadership qualities in my mind. But I felt strongly that the Lord was asking me to lead, so in little ways, I just started to. I went ahead with the vision. I went ahead taking steps towards making the group a reality, trying not to worry what other people thought, trying to make decisions that would bring unity and peace to the whole group. I allowed people to decide on a different path for their family if, you know, that was what they needed, without taking it as a personal affront to me and my idea. And things started to work out and come together. And one by one, practical obstacles were taken care of, and what I ended up with was almost too many students, and I had to cap off the registration. And for the first time in many years, I was so incredibly happy at work because I felt such a strong sense of purpose. And I was in a job that was just like an amazing match for all of my skills. It wasn't totally perfect from then on forward, and I struggled with fear throughout the first few months. So one of my main visions for the group was to be a place where believers and unbelievers could interact with each other and care for each other, because I was noticing that there were a number of Christian families who were homeschoolers who had mothers that at one point wanted to be overseas missionaries. And these moms were talking to me and telling me how disappointed they were that they had to give up that dream, because now they find themselves like in the tiny confines of their home just teaching their own kids. And at the same time, I noticed that there was a lot of unbelievers who were choosing to homeschool because they wanted to really prioritize their children and their family in much the same way the Christian families did, only these families didn't have this built-in support network of a church community. And so they were really lonely, and they were weary, and they were struggling. And so for me, I'm looking at these two groups of people. This is where I need the headphone mic. And I just saw so clearly, we don't need to go overseas, you guys. There are people right here who need God's love. The problem, which was a great source of anxiety for me, was that these beautiful Christian children were in my class, and they were proclaiming things they knew to be true about God in a way that was really likely to offend all the people who didn't share their beliefs. And I was really worried that before we even got started, we'd be like splitting up into two groups, because I couldn't like get these people kind of to see each other. And so this came to a head just after Halloween last year, so it was like a year ago, when one of this dear little souls in my class, we're sitting around having lunch together, all the kids, and we sit as a table like a family. And this little girl starts saying, "Halloween is from Satan, and anyone who participates in Halloween is evil." And then she starts talking about how all the clowns at Halloween are going to murder children, which I don't know if you remember the news last year about all those scary clowns. So my group is a multi-age group, and we've got kindergartens up to grade 6. And so this is one of the older kids, and these kindies' eyes are getting really big, like, "Oh my gosh, we're all going to die." No. Like, oh no, this is not what I wanted. I can't even describe how much in a panic I was at that moment. So I just want to encourage everyone in your own faith, or when you're teaching your children, just, you know, include some basic social skills when we talk on how to talk about our faith. That would be helpful. So it's funny now, but I already knew there was one family who was really uncomfortable being around all these Christians. And I was pretty sure this conversation with the kids really was not going to be helpful. It was just, yeah, it's funny now, but I was in so much of a panic. These conversations had been surfacing, and this was kind of the most abrasive one that came out. So I shared with my friend, because I was like, oh my gosh, you've got to pray. This is crazy. I don't even know how these other families are going to take these statements, or what their kids are going to say when they come home and tell their mom about their day. And I asked her to pray, and she came back with this verse. This is from 1 John chapter 4, verse 18. It says, There is no fear in love. But perfect love drives out fear because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. And, you know, in that moment, I was afraid. So she encouraged me to love each of the children and each of the families because love is the antidote to fear. And this verse totally transformed my perspective and became my mantra for the year. So I found ways, I just started thinking differently, and I just started thinking, okay, I'm going to bring love into my words. I'm going to bring love into my actions, into my thoughts for each family and for each child. So I loved on that kid who said the most wacky and offensive things, because it didn't stop there. There was more. And I loved those families who felt that maybe they didn't belong with a whole bunch of religious people. And I really don't think I was truly afraid from that moment onward. And if I got there, I just remembered, okay, there's no fear in love. And the most beautiful things started happening, or the most beautiful things did happen. Every single family reported how thankful they were for the group, how loved they felt, how important it had been for their kids. And I actually had a number of people who really profoundly struggled with fear and anxiety that were a part of my class. And I watched as God brought freedom and healing to these kids and to their parents in this area. Personally, I just have never been happier in a job in my whole life. So to me, this sounds like God. This sounds like something he would do, that he would give a vision, that he would give the gifts, that he'd give the challenge to invest them. And then it was just like, just watch what he's going to do. It's his work, and we get to just share in his happiness. I do think I could have made things a lot easier on myself if I hadn't even entertained fear in the first place. But just imagine if I had just let fear rule in the initial decision-making process. Because God's kingdom isn't about giving us something to bury for our own use, or even for his use. It's about multiplication. We multiply our investment, and it's multiplication of blessing and freedom and love and joy and peace and all these things, not just for us, but for everyone around us. So last year at the IF conference, we heard this woman, Jill Briscoe, speak, and she's a missionary. She was 86, I think. Maybe someone correct me who was there when she spoke. And just somebody that when you listen to them, you're like, okay, a lot of gravity, because she knows. She's been there. Someone that makes a really deep impression. And so she's speaking about her life and service to Jesus. And she shared how she had just come from teaching the Bible to women in a closed country where they studied for 3 days in a room with blackout blinds, because they didn't want their activity to be discovered and their lives to be endangered. And she spoke of these women who had left children at home, not knowing if their kids would even be there when they got back if someone discovered where they were. So I'm a mom, I can't even imagine how much courage that took. And Jill spoke openly about being afraid every single time the Lord called her to step out in faith. Every time. But that after obedience, after she obeyed God's call, that the courage she needed was always waiting for her. So that really made an impression on me, and I thought about that a lot this year. And hearing that, I started thinking really differently about fear, because it's something I've struggled with my whole life, and it would be so nice if I didn't have that, if I didn't have to fight that. think I've always prayed that God would just remove that problem. But what if fear is always present there? What if we always have the choice to sit in fear, burying the thing of value God gave us, or we have a choice to trust in God and invest the bag of gold and join him in his amazing work? You know, whether we're asked to cross the room to speak with someone new and that just seems like something really small, but we might be afraid to do that. Or maybe we're afraid to step up and he's asking us to lead in our home, or he's asking us to lead in our workplace, or he's asking us to humble ourselves to mend a broken relationship. Or maybe he would like us to stand up for injustice, or maybe just to confess your sin. Maybe he's asking you to submit to accountability for your struggle. I think all of these things would, depending on what your thing is, it's going to make you afraid. We're going to be scared. But what if courage and love are choices we make not in the absence of fear, but in the face of it? And we can make the choice because we know that God, our Master, is so, so good. And he's giving us something of great value, but the gift doesn't work if we do not open it and we don't use it. So I don't even know what the parable means when it says a talent or a bag of gold, because all of these are like allegorical, or it might mean a skill, it might mean wealth, actual money, it might mean a talent that you have, it might mean a spiritual gift or a gift of forgiveness, or maybe God is just requesting your presence on some adventure. I don't know what it is for each person, but whatever it is, I'm really confident God has a purpose residing in each of us that needs to be acted on, to be experienced and enjoyed. Yeah, so I'm just praying that we will trust him, to follow his lead and to accept his instructions, because living a life in fear is its own punishment. We have the alternative that 1 John tells us about, to know and rely on the love that God has for us, because God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God, and God in them. And there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear. Yeah, when we live in love and obedience to God, then we share in the happiness of the full life that he has planned for us. I think Pastor Ken has some questions for us to consider.